Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, vaccines. Mm-hmm. I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but I am increasingly falling into the camp that might be mistakenly labeled it if lack of subtlety were applied to my thinking.
Which so, it will be.
Which it will be.
Yep. It's already too late.
It's already too
right
late.
Now. You've already dug your own grave.
No. So I have not. I've not gotten the vaccine. I had COVID in December. I've worn a mask when I've gone places. I really haven't. I mean, California just opened up 3 days ago, and mm-hmm. I was on an airplane in a mask, and then. At a wedding, not in a mask, with my family who was predominantly vaccinated. So that's the most exposure that I've had. Mm-hmm. In any event, the vaccine thing is interesting because what I have planned for later today is to go get an antibody test, which will tell me if I have the immunity to fight COVID.
Sure. Makes sense.
I can, at the same place, get a COVID test, which will tell me if I have active coronavirus.
Right.
Those two tests together, and correct me if I'm wrong if you're out there and you're a scientist and I'm misunderstanding things, will tell me if I have coronavirus and if I am possibly contagious. But I cannot at our gym.
And also if you have natural immunity to it from having been sick.
Yes, which will deplete over time. Same with the vaccine.
Same as the vaccine, yeah.
If I provide that to our gym, which is now saying that you need vaccine cards to go in, and by the way, this is not a private decision by a private business. This is a publicly mandated California thing if you want to enter into most establishments. They won't let me in with that. Mm-hmm. And we'll say that I'm anti-science if I don't get the vaccine. And I think it's...
Well, I think the stranger part to me is like, that's true if you had COVID a month ago as well. And we all agree that there is some level of natural immunity that occurs when you get COVID, for some period of time.
Last I looked,
which I don't remember when this was like a 0.6% infection rate. And I don't know over what period of time that is, but I'm sure it was over longer than a month. So if you had COVID a month ago... probably lower than a 0.6% chance that you can get it, even if you are exposed to the virus by talking to someone who has it. Mm-hmm. But even if you show them you had it a month ago, that is not going to cut it. It needs to be a vaccine card. So yes, we aren't necessarily interested in, are you immune? Do you have the antibodies? It's have you done the vaccine?
We've lost the thread. Like the God is becoming get vaccinated and not don't be dangerous. It's disturbing to me because I wonder, when does this stop? Like, it's not going away. We've effectively eradicated the vaccines that are mandated in order to go to public schools. They do come back when some people don't get their kids vaccinated, measles, rubella, mumps, all that kind of stuff. But I can't imagine a world in which COVID is not just a circulating thing.
Of course, it'll be like the flu.
Like the flu. So are we going to have forever private businesses mandated by the government that you must check vaccine cards and they expire after 6 months to a year forever? Like what are we doing? What is the plan here?
Well, and the thing I think is interesting is how, and I think it's new and also it hit the world very hard, but it's a very unique to COVID type thing. Cause like I used to train MMA and that involved, I was on a fight team, not just showing up for classes. That involved training where people would get bloody noses sometimes or have cuts from scrapes from grappling or whatever. And no one ever had to show that they didn't have active HIV. So you could just walk in with HIV, not on meds to suppress it, get punched in the face, be bleeding on the ground, have a cut on your arm while we're grappling, and no one would know. It just wasn't mandated. Nobody told you that you had to share that.
Now, I'm sure there are private gyms that ask for, you know, there's probably a gym somewhere in America that says, hey, this is a private thing that we do and you need to have.
The only time I ever heard about it was before an actual fight, mm-hmm. before you were going to be paid to fight, then you would have to get the test. But I'd never heard about it for a gym, which is totally fine. But it's just interesting to me because, like, certainly we would argue that that's more risky. Now, what I think the argument would be is it's rarer, right?
Like, but not a lot of people. Do you need, if you add up all the things you don't need to be tested for, like flu, pneumonia, you know, like there's.
You just didn't need any test. Before COVID, there were things that were dangerous. You didn't need any tests to go do anything.
We didn't need to mitigate the danger of everything that could hurt or maim or kill a person. You were allowed to go fight someone.
Yeah. Encouraged.
You didn't need. You're allowed to go get punched in the face. It is strange. I think COVID is being treated like, to a degree, the arguments that I hear for it treat it like it's the one of the only things that kills people. Like we're elves that could sail off into the West if not for COVID, ending our lives short. So we just have to do everything that we can to make sure that it doesn't kill anyone. Mm-hmm. And I'm just surprised. There were communicable diseases that killed people before this. We accepted a level of risk when we went out. If you wanted the flu vaccine, you were allowed to get it.
Well, I think the math has totally changed now that there is a vaccine. Because before there's a vaccine, we don't know what this is. We've never encountered it before. I mean, at some point, we don't know how deadly it is even, right? So you treat it with, the more uncertainty you have, the more caution.
I'm speaking very specifically about a point in time.
But I'm saying right now, it's like if you're worried about it, you can get the vaccine. That changes a lot of things. Versus pre-vaccine, it's like, well, you're endangering people who don't feel safe and have no means of protecting themselves. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. Of course. The only possible thing is immunocompromised people who cannot get the vaccine are endangered. As I was thinking about this, I was like, you know, one of the things that I have appreciated because it doesn't affect me, but I, as I reflect on it, is not necessarily a place that I want the government stepping in because it's like this, is with banning smoking in private establishments. Mm-hmm. Like you can't smoke, I think, in California restaurants. And as I reflect on it, I'm like, if I'm a business owner and I own a restaurant and I'm a smoker and I want a smoking section, why the fuck can't I? Like, can't the citizens make decisions for themselves?
Yeah, you're saying if you don't want to sit and smoke, just don't go to that restaurant.
Go to a different restaurant. Yeah. And if you're a private gym, by the way, and you want to mandate that people have vaccines and you're not interested in any antibody test, I think that's fine.
Well, it's your house. You can do, I think exactly. You can do whatever you want. You can make whatever.
What my problem is very specifically with the blanket mandate that every private establishment that is basically indoors in California must have a vaccine test, and that an antibody test and negative PCR test doesn't substitute. That to me feels like comply. And if people are curious why I don't want to get it, the reason that I don't want to get it is the risk reward in my category leads me to not want it. Like I had COVID. It was for me, a 3-day sickness. It was not horrible. I understand that a lot of people, when they get the vaccine, they get like a 1 or 2 day sickness that is very similar to that. So I'm not like, I don't want it again. I'd prefer to not have COVID or the vaccine abbreviated COVID. And additionally, I know that a lot of people say these things are safe, which I believe that the clinical trials have, you know, gone through, and I don't doubt that. I just know that no one has had these for 20 years. And you and I have talked, like, things that were safe when they came out, and then 20 years later were determined to increase your risk of cancer. The list is so long, I don't want to play, but like, you were saying, I don't know if this is true, and I don't want to repeat it. Did doctors prescribe smoking at one point? You were telling me? Is that true?
Yeah. Well, either doctors or psychiatrists. Like, yeah, cigarettes were a thing that we were given for either anxiety or some sort of physical ailment. It was you'd go to an expert and they would give you the suggestion to smoke cigarettes.
Sure. And we can, you know, asbestos was used to insulate things. And, you know, there's all these things that have no problem in the first 12 months.
I mean, we only know plastics should be BPA free because we were drinking out of plastics that had BPAs for a while. And then people said, oh, these are actually making people sick.
And for what it's worth, like, there's always this cascading thing. Like, we find out that sugar causes diabetes. So we start with high fructose corn syrup, which we find out is worse. And then we give you like erythromycin. And
sucralose.
Like, so far, sucralose. And so far, that's fine. It's like, in 15 years, we'll know that sucralose does something bad. And there's something in this that isn't a BPA that isn't good for
people. Yeah. And this, by the way, it actually isn't to say that the vaccine has any consequences. It's just to say,
we don't know. Yeah.
Anyone who wants it can get it. And if we don't feel like getting it, it's not, I don't think it's an insane, like, Tea Party position.
Yes. Though it is often, I feel like, represented as such. Yeah. And especially I'm going like, I'm going this afternoon to get my, cause truly, if I don't have antibodies, my personal calculation changes. Cause I really don't want to get sick. I did not enjoy being sick. So I'm going, do I want the guaranteed where they inject me?
And you don't want to get other people sick, but if you have the antibodies, then it's like having the vaccine. You're just as likely to not transfer it because you have immunity, which is what we're solving for.
And so if I come back negative for antibodies, I may very well go get the vaccine. Like I'm not saying that this is going to kill me. I just think that it is a very high likelihood of a short illness and a very small likelihood of long-term, very, very small, of long-term some things. Mm-hmm. And given that I don't necessarily need it to protect others or myself, I don't want to have to get it.
Sure.
But they are. And then the concern is that I mentioned earlier, but it's like, when does this stop?
If you
like,
had kids, would you give them the other standard vaccines?
Yeah.
Because they've been around for longer, so you feel like there's more data on if
It's also, yes, I'd probably look them up because I've never had to make this decision in the past, mm-hmm. and I do some reading, but my sense is that that kills kids at like a
not having the vaccine.
Yes, yeah. At a higher level than COVID is killing healthy 33-year-olds. And to be clear, if you're not a healthy 33-year-old, the vaccine is there so that healthy 33-year-olds do not kill you, and I'll wear a mask on an airplane and all that other kind of stuff. So yeah, it just feels, it's also like, if, I don't know, if my kid had measles, rubella, and mumps antibodies, I don't know that I'd rush to get them the vaccine, right? Like, I'm under the impression they come into this world without that.
Right.
Which is not the case that I find myself in right now. So it's a very particular disagreement that I find, but I think there's a lot of people in my situation that have had it and are just not being accounted for. And I think it's disturbing, the rhetoric around it and the demands to comply and the government stepping in such a big way. And as I was thinking about smoking, I'm like, I hate smoking. I don't like it. I wouldn't want to go to the restaurant that smelled like smoke from the other section.
Mm-hmm.
But I think people need to be allowed to do things that the government doesn't think are good for them, you know? So that's my vaccine stance. I'm curious if I got anything wrong, if I'm misunderstanding that I'm not, you know, my antibodies are somehow significantly different than.
Well, I think the biggest counter argument would be that it's not just a decision for you, right? It's a decision about the disease and the spread of the disease. But I think if you have the natural antibodies, that should have the exact same effect as having the antibodies from the vaccine.
What I'm suggesting is that I produce for these establishments an antibody positive test and a negative PCR test that says I don't have COVID and I'm immune.
Sure.
Why do I need a vaccine? And if you tell me that I do, I go, this is disturbing to me. Like, unless I'm misunderstanding the science, that would then become the anti-science position to say, no, you have to follow this particular course of action that is now divorced from the outcome that we want, which is to not get sick and to not get other people sick.
I just looked it up a little bit. So basically what the science says is that the reason you get the vaccine is because your antibodies produced naturally will only cover like a handful of variants, whereas the vaccine will cover a much wider range.
Got it.
So I don't know if that changes your mind, but
yeah, I mean, I'd have to understand it. How long? I guess my understanding of everything is that there's a lifespan, right? Like the vaccine does not last forever, correct? Mm. So that a vaccine that is 8 months old and a antibody from a naturally born COVID that is 1 month old, you might be better off with a 1 month old having had COVID. I guess the point is that we have this like vaccine God, and there's no nuance admitted into the conversation, which is like, if I just got over COVID and you had a vaccine 8 months ago, who's safer? Or if you had a vaccine 12 months ago, or I don't know.
Well, the vaccines, I mean, unless it's different than the flu, it also won't cover all the variants, right? Because that's the flu shot. We just guess what variant it's going to be that season.
Yeah, the vaccine never really wears off. The variants just get too varied. Mm-hmm. And then we just develop a new one and whatever. But
yes. That is my basic understanding, is that it mutates over the course of time. And we have the rough period of a year where we say, okay, probably time to get something else.
But they get it wrong with the flu sometimes, right? You just get a vaccine and then it's just not the flu that they have that year. And so you get the flu anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be curious how COVID, how the pharmaceutical companies, I guess, who design this are going to deal with COVID variants when it comes. Like if they can do better than they've done with the flu shots.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing, and we don't need to talk about it, but I'll just refer people to it, that has made me, and I've been, I think, skeptical, not of science, of humans, and some of whom are in scientific professions. There's a really interesting podcast on Dark Horse with Brett Weinstein, and I forget the doctor's name, who was big on ivermectin as a treatment for COVID.
And this might get us taken down.
You think so?
I don't know.
I can't even say that.
Are you not allowed to say the word ivermectin?
I think people are getting taken down for just saying it. I can't remember if it's here or
I'm going to say though. It. Take me down. I think there's a podcast that if that gets me taken down, I will be flabbergasted. Check out the Brett Weinstein podcast. That's what I'm going to say. If that gets me taken down,
well, I'm confused.
I'll
so
be
he
flabbergasted.
He is a doctor who's claiming that this medicine helps relieve COVID symptoms, right? Are they taking him down because they disagree with his research? Because I thought he just had a bunch of peer-reviewed research published.
I mean, that's what he talks about in the podcast.
So sorry, but YouTube's position is that they think his research is bad science.
YouTube's position is that the CDC is your Lord and Savior. And if they don't say it's the case, then you can't say it. It's disturbing, honestly. They talk about it. And the fact that we all just got a little bit panicked in here because I
said, well, I'm not panicked because I don't mind. Say it, dude. Say your shit. The worst thing they do is they take it down.
Oh, no. I don't want to overstep my understanding of it, which is just to refer you to that thing. I found it interesting to listen to. They have this exact conversation. They have a minute 30 preamble. We're like, YouTube, this is a doctor. He is doing peer-reviewed studies. Do not take this down. They still got to take it down.
Is it Dr. Robert Malone?
I don't know.
Inventor of mRNA vaccine technology from June 11th?
I think if you type in ivermectin Brett Weinstein, you'll find the podcast. I could look at his face to see if that's him. He's kind of a, what's the word? He's like burly in stature. In any event, we can continue.
Oh, here we go. I Googled ivermectin Brett Weinstein and the first thing is a Vice article. Why is the intellectual dark web suddenly hyping an unproven COVID treatment?
It's, and again, I'm not saying that it's just check it out. It's interesting. It's,
I guess he was just on Joe
interesting
Rogan.
To listen to. What's fascinating to me is how confident in science so many journalists and people at YouTube are.
I think it's Dr. Pierre Corey.
Yeah, that sounds more correct.
Dr. Pierre Corey.
That sounds more correct. That's him.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it was just interesting to listen to. It might not be true. It was an interesting listen.
I want to read this Vice article now.
No, you don't. You don't want to read Vice articles. They rot your brain. All right. I got more stuff. You ready?
Yeah, go for it.
So,
I'm just going to quietly read while you talk.
You'll like this one, I think. So there is a, it came out, there was an investigative thing in Britain that Amazon is destroying products at their factories. Something like 130,000 products at one factory per week are being destroyed by Amazon.
Okay.
And I thought this was interesting because this is one story that beyond the headline I have some insight into because I know a lot of friends who do FBA. And it's like...
Well, used to do FBA.
Used to do
FBA. A lot of it didn't work out.
A lot of it didn't work out. They had to destroy their products, which is what I'm going to say. It's so...
For people who don't know, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but FBA is... That was like the trend of
make money
online, live on the beach. You know those photos where someone's sitting in the sand with their laptop? Like that dream was fulfilled by Amazon. It was the idea that you could, with no effort, skill, or added value on your part, take a product from China, sell it on Amazon. Never take inventory. Don't innovate to make the product good. You don't have to be... This isn't true. This is what's the promise. You don't have to be a particularly good marketer. You just... take a product from China, put it on Amazon, and then start cashing checks from the beach. That was the promise of like 3 years ago.
And to be clear, that was one way to do FBA. FBA just means fulfilled by Amazon. Which
you can do it.
You can make your own product and have Amazon fulfill it.
I know a guy who does it with, oh my God, I forget what they're called. He creates the suit that you put on to go sit in a swamp with a rifle if you want to paintball or hunt.
The ghillie suit.
He makes ghillie suits and they're super expensive, but he sells them on Amazon and makes a killing. His ghillie suits. You know what I mean? They're not just from they're not chintzy little plastic things from a factory. Mm. But I think the dream, which people bought into, was this idea that it was easy, required no skill, required no value added, required nothing, basically, except for that you're in on the secret. So that's why there was this surge in FBA.
Yes.
Which has subsequently gone away because people found out it's actually kind of hard and you need
to... gone away, totally. What they're saying now is Amazon automation. Like the promises, I'll get to the story, but the promises of free money they must grow exponentially. Before it was like, you set up your own product. Now it's like, you send me $10,000, I'll set up your product and you'll just cash checks. It's absurd.
Well, you have to move the offer though, because the offer doesn't work. And so then people get wise to that. So then you have to change your offer for how to be an entrepreneur with no effort or risk of failure. Like, the way you deliver that has to move over time because everything you offer isn't actually effective. And so people get wise to that. So then you need to shift your offer.
They call this the mechanism in marketing, which is like people have wanted the same things for a long time. Like we all want to be attractive, but you constantly have to shift the mechanism. So like it's the Bowflex one day, then it's like the ab squeezer one day, then it's something else because people have that desire and they still want it to be immediately fulfilled without effort.
They buy your pills that don't work and they buy your Bowflex that doesn't work.
You just got more mechanisms.
Yeah. So the mechanism for getting rich with no effort so you could live on the beach was, for a while, FBA.
Yes. So this comes out and it's like, as a medium, it's like, this is a non-story. Amazon, this is just written on their website. Like, this is the terms they have. If you want us to, we will ship you back your product at cost to you, which we've held in our warehouses, or you can pay a lesser fee and we'll dispose of it for you.
Right, because like, basically you were trying to sell rubber band bracelets. It didn't work out and you want to shut down your business, but we have 1,000 rubber band bracelets yeah. that belong to you that yeah. we're storing.
Well, so, it's just funny because the story is like, it's like somebody, Chuck E. Cheese, which was, I don't know if it's still around, is, you know, found out the kids were throwing like ball pit balls at each other and it's like breaking news, yeah. like kid pelts other child with
Chuck E. Cheese. Chuck E. Cheese throws out stale pizza at the end of the night.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what are you, of course this yeah. has been happening. So the fact that it's a leaked investigation, I just thought was such a funny framing because everyone knows this. This is, this is a non-secret.
On their website.
Secondarily, people's concept of numbers is, of course, we have none. We have no relative scale. Is 130,000 products out of single factory a lot or a little compared to what? Like,
yeah, yeah.
It just feels like a lot of yeah. products. But who knows how many it is. I don't know if it's the case, but I know that off of the people that I know, so many disposals. And if you think of the things that we've had people selling, a single person could liquidate 1,000 or 2,000 products like that. And mm-hmm. these are not big sellers. Like, oh, my... like food saver bags didn't work out. There goes 2,000 food saver bags this week.
Which you paid 10 cents for. So yes. From them, it's like, oh, I paid $200 for yeah. these. Just get rid of them.
Just burn them. And so they incinerate them. And it's not good. It's an indictment of the consumerist culture. It is all of these things, but it is not unique to Amazon. This is what businesses and people do. Like every time you're at dinner and don't eat your whole meal, you are participating in the same cost-benefit analysis.
I've always disliked this when you get physical spam mail.
Yeah.
It has always bothered me that they don't have to pay for the costs that they externalize. Mm. So they print coupons and they mail them to you and you don't want them and you call them and you say, please stop. And the next month they do it again anyway. Yeah. And you just can't get them to stop. And you have to throw it out or recycle it, at which point a recycling plant has to pay money to transform it into something else mm-hmm. or else it just fills a landfill. And it's like, this company can only do this because they aren't paying for all this downstream cost that they create by flippantly mailing people that don't want what they're sending.
That's an interesting thing. Like if you think of what a mailbox and even an email has become, you have to pay to send it there with physical mail, but you should almost have to pay for the space in that individual's mailbox. Like I don't want your crap in my mailbox.
I've always thought this was bullshit because of how hard it is to get them to stop.
Yeah.
Like I've told you not to. You are mailing me garbage that I don't want, that I don't remember yeah. signing up for. And now I have to dispose of it.
You didn't sign up.
Company.
You didn't sign up. You have an address.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm unsolicited getting garbage sent to me that yeah. I don't want. And you won't listen to me when I tell you to stop. And then I have to give someone else the garbage that they then have to pay
yeah.
to get rid of. And you don't bear those costs. So to you, it makes sense to keep sending garbage randomly to every address in the world mm-hmm. because some of them become customers and the ones that don't, not my problem.
Yeah, it's cheap enough.
It's always bothered
me. To buy paper in bulk is cheap.
Yeah.
That's capitalism has lots of problems with externalities for sure. This particular one, my take was that Amazon gets beat up on for things that we demand Amazon do and that we all participate in at our own scale, probably mm-hmm. relative to Amazon. I would bet that Amazon, this is just a guess, has more programs to redistribute the stuff that they don't use than most Americans.
Like, who just throw out junk when they don't want it anymore.
Yeah. Whatever they don't want. Like, and some people will take it to Goodwill and this.
Some people also just hoard that stuff in
yeah,
a basement.
Yeah. They just bear the costs of storage. But it was just interesting to have a little bit of knowledge and see some of the comment outrage and you go, this is being funded by a bunch of one people on FBA and that create products that can't be sold and other weird regulations. This was another thing. We, at the convenience stores where we grew up, they would like throw out food at the end of the night, and mm-hmm. we would ask, and there was regulations because the food could be spoiled. So there's these weird incentives.
Oh, you couldn't. I tried.
They wouldn't let you. Like, I'm sorry. We want to donate all of these soft pretzels at the end of the day to a food bank. We would love to.
You could not, as a high school kid,
yeah.
go to a Dunkin' Donuts, get all of their leftovers from the day, and drive it to a homeless shelter yeah. yourself. You just couldn't do it.
Yes.
Wasn't allowed.
Because it was, they were either the liability or the legalities. It was like, we can't because it could be spoiled and it's technically bad and we're not allowed to do it. So we've got a lot of weird incentives.
Except in Vegas. Vegas is good. They give them all to pig farms.
Oh, yeah?
I think so. All the Vegas buffets and stuff.
Oh, really?
They ship. Yeah, if you don't eat their sushi and caviar for the day, oh, then man. They just ship it to a pig farm, I think.
That's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, somebody, I mean, again, and I've had dumb ideas, but I was watching, I think, Crystal and Sagar, and Crystal said she suspected it was to maintain high prices. It's like, that's, no. This is not why they're doing this. It's to not pay storage fees for stuff that people don't want. It's not like,
no, not
it's
just
not the, diamonds not, where they're artificially inflating the price of things.
It's not to, it's not because Amazon is saying that people don't want to buy it, just to be clear. It's mm-hmm. because the seller says, Amazon, I don't want you to store it anymore.
That's FBA, but I'm sure that Amazon has their own products that they're not doing. And it's just because it costs a lot of money to distribute stuff. If you've ever tried to give away your old stuff, it, you know, it's like, who wants it? Like, a handful of things go quickly in the garage sale, and a lot of it is really hard to move.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it takes a full day, and it's probably not worth the effort if you were to measure the cash that you got out of it. If you measure the satisfaction for having rehomed some of your old things, maybe it is. But it's just interesting that, I mean, I've probably made that jump. I was wrong the other week about Fauci's emails coming from a leak, and it came from something else. It came from a governmental
freedom
request,
of information.
Freedom of information. It's just, yeah, it's just how easy it is to like read a headline, intuit something, and get it completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So one other big switch.
Sure.
Ben Simmons.
Oh, come on.
I feel so bad for that guy, dude.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to try to rag on him.
No, I feel horrible. So if you don't know, Ben Simmons is a Philadelphia Sixers player. He's been trusting the process for several years. It's what we say in Philadelphia when we can't win anything. We just trust the process.
Trust the process. Trust the process.
Trust the process.
Yeah, he had a rough playoff series. He didn't take any shots in the fourth quarter of many games. He averaged like 9 points or 7 points. It was not a good look. He was scared to do free throws.
He's an interesting case study in having your head messed up.
Yeah, he's just, you know, I think it's weird. We have Mental Health Awareness Month. We have empathy for people who have mental health issues. But when a pro athlete is clearly suffering from some form of anxiety, the city of Philadelphia also is especially bad at this. They just shit on him. I was actually thinking about this. I'm from Philly. I'm a Philly sports fan. Like, if you made me pick my team in every sport, it's Philly. We do this to ourselves, though. Like, Fultz had the yips. Simmons has the yips. It's not good to be terrified that if you fuck up, your fans will turn on you and throw batteries at you. That's just not a good environment to succeed. Like, you really need to not do that if you want to win anything. I don't know how else to say it. Like, Philly is going to blame everybody else, but the collective fan base and the toxic culture is a huge part of what's causing this.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. I think
yeah,
I
it's hilarious. They are.
I don't know. Is that?
Yes, we're the worst. No, we're the worst. Everyone thinks we're the worst.
Okay.
I mean, there's a couple people that are tied, but for turning on your own team, Philly is renowned as being the city that turns on its own team. Everybody boos other teams. Everybody heckles other teams. We boo ourselves. We throw batteries at ourselves. We heckle ourselves. And what do you know? That's not a good way to instill confidence in your players.
Yeah.
So to some extent, I say, shut up if you want this to stop happening. And you're a Philly fan who's sending him death threats via Twitter.
Yeah.
It's like, you're an idiot.
Yeah.
If you're sending Ben Simmons a death threat because he missed a free throw, delete all your social media.
Yeah.
And get help. Like,
he needs Tony Robbins, man. He is a phenomenally physically talented person.
Yep.
Who forgot that he's right-handed.
Well, no, this is the other thing. So this, if people don't know, Ben Simmons, when he was a kid, showed extremely high potential as an athlete. And his father wanted him to be ambidextrous because it would make him a better basketball player. And in the process, people think
screwed up.
He ended up making him shoot with the wrong hand. So if you've ever thrown a football or shot a basketball with your left hand and you're right-handed, that's what he's doing all the time, people suspect. And it's not it's because, the story goes, it's because of his dad training him to try to use both hands and then getting confused on what his dominant hand is. But the guy will go on a talk show and pantomime. He goes, yeah, so I used to shoot into a trash can. And the hand he uses without thinking is the hand he doesn't shoot with. Mm-hmm. So I think his dad accidentally, I mean, obviously, first of all, it worked. The guy's on a Mac contract.
Yeah.
Dad, if your goal was to make money, you killed it. But accidentally may have taught him to shoot with the wrong hand.
Well, I have felt like Ben Simmons before. Like, I am, even in intramural games, like, at the end of the game, I'm like, I want the ball. I'm going to score. That's not the guy that I am.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been the Ben Simmons, like, here you go. So he's got the now memeable thing where he's got a dunk on a 6 foot tall guy. He's 6'11", and he dishes under the basket.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in that position, and I feel like he really, what is happening from my perspective is he has catastrophized so many times about screwing it up and seen himself miss so many foul shots in his mm-hmm. mind's eye and clank a dunk off the back of the rim and felt the booze so many times
in his head
that he's practiced blowing it
yeah.
so many times, which is the opposite of what he needs to do, which is the Conor McGregor, like, I seen this moment in my head.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he hasn't seen a good end of the game maybe ever.
Mentally, you're saying. Mentally. Yeah, if anyone ever saw our video on visualization by Conor McGregor, you're saying he's taking a lot of mental reps of
he's lost 100 times.
Yeah.
And so he's making the right call, which is like, I've blown this 100 times before, a million times before. And he clearly, if you look at him in like preseason when shit doesn't matter, where he's not catastrophizing, he's aggressive and mm-hmm. really good. It's just sad. I hope that Tony Robbins reaches out to him and brain wipes him.
Yeah, because yeah.
he needs it, man.
Sure.
He needs it so bad.
It's also funny. I'm a Sixers fan. I love the Sixers. I was really bummed when we lost. I watched that game live. But it is also an interesting look in scapegoating, I think, because our coach has blown 11 playoff series where he had the lead in the series. And that's the most ever. And he has the record, I think, for blowing the biggest lead in a playoff game, which is with the Sixers, 26-point lead in the third quarter. And he has a pattern of blowing it.
But I don't understand this. This is a genuine question. How influential is the coach in the third quarter? Isn't the coach's job to like draw schemes that get you to the third quarter?
You have a 26-point lead.
Yeah.
Your bench is in. It cuts to 24.
Oh, he left the bench in. He left, 18, he left the bench in.
To 16. To 6.
Oh, he didn't like...
let's put the starters back out there.
Oh, really?
And Joel Embiid thought he was done for the day. He's playing on a torn meniscus. Thought he was going to just stop playing.
Well, that's to be fair, that's the right call with Joel, who has a tournament. We don't need to talk too much sports here, but like, if you're up 26,
you call a timeout.
Yeah.
You draw up a play.
Yeah, yeah.
I watched the last game. I don't think we scored on a single out of timeout play.
You're saying you like interrupt the flow of them.
It's a momentum game. Yeah. We went from 26 to 20. Let's call a timeout. Let's draw up a play that involves a back pick that gets us an open dunk like Popovich would do for the Spurs. It's like, we're calling timeouts so that our center can get the ball at the 3-point line.
Yeah.
Like, this was our play.
Yeah.
It's he has just done it more than anybody. He blows games, he blows series, and no one's really talking about it because he like took Ben Simmons and just put him in front of him and said, look at this guy. And Ben Simmons played bad too. But listen, Joel Embiid went 0 for 12 in the fourth quarter in a game they lost. There's a lot of blame to go around.
Sure.
But everyone's talking about this one guy. That's what I find interesting. It's like, how did you guys convince the world that you had nothing to do with this?
Oh, no. I mean, Ben Simmons is supposed to be a star, and he played like... an eighth man. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't there. I have a bunch of random stuff if you want me to continue, if you have anything related
to the Sixers. I can't say I do. I have things, but
okay, well, we'll just do mine, then we'll do yours.
Sure.
So I had a wedding. It wasn't my wedding, it was my sister's wedding.
Mazel tov.
It was very interesting to sit there. I have not been to many weddings because I don't like to travel, and they're almost always not where I am because I've lived in different cities. And
you weren't in a fraternity.
I wasn't in a fraternity.
That'll like quadruple your wedding invites.
That'll blow it up. So I've not been to many, and it's been many years since I've been to one, but I was struck by how romantic it is.
It touched you?
No. I mean this like neutrally, like without judgment on the romanticism or negative or positive. It is, I mean, I'm sitting there next to my 9-year-old cousin, or I guess second cousin, daughter of my cousin, I don't know. And I'm just going, well, my sister's up there, and they're saying the nicest things to each other in the vows that they've written, mm-hmm. and you're my person, and you make me better every day, and it's just like, I'm going, I want some of that. Like, I'll take that. You know what I mean? Like, this sounds awesome. Wait a second. Also, everybody has to look at you and tell you you're great for like 8 hours. This is sick. So my thought was, for better or worse, and this is just about weddings in general, not this particular one, is I see why everybody wants one. Mm-hmm. I get now at a deeper felt level why people say, like, I just want my person. Like, no kidding you do. Like, the whole thrust of it was... It's just awesome. It's like, who wouldn't want someone who makes them their best self every single day for the rest of time, who promises to be kind, caring, and understanding, and if there's ever a problem to get over. It's like, look, if I believed that that was the likely outcome of a wedding, I would probably be married already.
Oh, dude, if I didn't know divorce rates, if I was like, oh yeah, the divorce rate's 2%, most people that get married stay together, and
whatever
also
you say in your vows is what happens. I'd be like, oh my God, sign me up.
Self-reported happiness goes through the roof when you get married. It's like, I'm not structurally opposed to this. Yeah. Like,
yes. That was my sense as I was sitting there, and I'm going, am I missing something? And
well, it's like the real world equivalent of Instagram, in the sense that you'll have a couple go up there and you are my person, the light of my life. You pick me up when I'm down. It's like, didn't I see you guys fight a week ago and 3 weeks ago and 5 weeks ago, and you almost broke up 9 weeks ago, and you cheated on each other 12 weeks ago? It's like, I don't think that she's actually, or he's actually, like, picking you up every time you're down. But the vows are
awesome,
on point.
Yeah. I felt a bit like this. I guess I'm weird. I felt like an anthropologist, like watching a ritual. From a interested perspective. Like, wow, this is fascinating. And the question that I had is, like, are these vows, which will, no doubt, and I mean this in every case, my sisters included, like, these will be broken within 30 days. Like, you will be crass and not forgiving. And like, you, and that's not to say that that's a bad marriage. It's just like, you cannot live up to the vow. If you listen to what people say, these will be broken. And even if you make tentative vows, they'll be broken within 6 months to a year, because relationships are tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. I listened to one guy whose vow was, I'm going to try my best. I bet that he's mostly stuck to it.
Try his best? I mean, even that's, I guess, yeah. If you're like, look, I'm going to be me, and you're going
to
be me.
It was actually weird to see, because it was my two friends were getting married, and one was like,
I'm going
to
do my
very
best.
Very over, just like that would be me. Full romance, full over the top, like the vows you dream of. And then another person was just like, you know, I'm going to, I get annoyed sometimes, but I'm going to try to fight that. And I'm playing it up a little bit, but it was stark. I remember watching being like, ooh, that's got to hurt after you just shared your heart.
You know, that would be me. And I actually was like, is there value to making promises that you recognize are impossible to keep in front of a group of people who will pretend that they're possible to keep? And I think there is, from a community perspective. Like, it keeps families together when everyone out there is sitting and has watched you say this. And it's very easy to, you know, publicly to talk about this, but it's very much more difficult publicly to talk about troubles. Mm-hmm. Obviously that comes with downsides, but I do think what it does is it keeps family units working through problems, because...
Well, I don't think the vows really mean anything anymore. I think back in the day with a small town, maybe there was a time where a husband and wife fought and someone was like, well, remember your vows. This is part of being married, is you have to, through thick and thin. But now it's like, I don't think
the vows, though. It's tougher to get divorced than it is to break up, because it's embarrassing. You've promised everyone that you love, and you made them come, and they gave you a card. Like, yeah. It is embarrassing.
It's weird to think about that and then think about how common divorce is.
Oh, I think that I've never been there, but I imagine that you must feel like a failure if you get a divorce, because you made a promise in front of everyone you love that this wouldn't happen.
Divorce people who are listening, chime in the comments. Be curious if you did feel like a failure, or if you're like, nah, you guys are way off base. It was awesome.
And I want to make this clear. This isn't about my sister's wedding in particular. I was like a scientist out there. I'm like studying. And I think that though I suspect that there's value to that. If your goal is to maintain the most number of people in relationship to one another, even if that relationship is tumultuous and lacks healthy sex life, or, you know, the things that can sometimes happen in long-term relationships.
I wonder, because I do know Esther Perel would say that the idolizing of relationships is actually one of the things leading to people being unhappy in relationships or feeling like a failure in the sense that like you're up there, you're seeing the marriage, the amazing vows. Oh my God. And you're sitting next to your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife. And you go, oh my God, we had a fight last week. Yeah. Like, are we broken? I don't feel this way. 2 weeks ago, he needed to have me pick him up from the airport. And I said, nah, I get an Uber. Like, are we messed up?
Yeah.
And her thing, because she's all about monogamy, is we have specifically a myth in the United States, at least, that if your eyes wander, if you look at another person and think they're attractive, or if you have a dream of having sex with someone that isn't your significant other, it's an indication that your relationship is flawed. You're unhappy. Maybe this isn't your person, or your sex life isn't as good as it should be. Something is wrong. And she says, that's just being human. Seeing someone attractive walk by, go, oh, look at that. And then your subconscious one night a year goes, oh, sex with that person in your dreams. And it's like, you're just doing it right. And
you're really, I mean, one night, that would
no, be I'm impressive. Saying, I agree. I'm saying like, this is, people think that they're failing when they have totally human, absolutely not failure screw ups.
She goes even further than that and says that we should aim for monogamish, which is like couple slip ups over the course of a lifetime.
So I'm not going to stand on that or not, because I haven't thought about this at all. Yeah. I never had a lifelong relationship, but I do think it sets you up to resent the other person, to resent yourself, to feel like a failure, to feel shame because you're doing something that everybody's doing, but everybody's pretending they're not doing.
Yes. Well, I guess what has happened is that the value of the ritual, given the technology we had and the towns that we lived in, was like very, very valuable up until a certain time, and now is needing to morph to something else, which I think acknowledges that relationships are not totally lovey-dovey, peachy, romantic things all the time. And I tend to agree with you in 2021. And this wedding did have that. The vows that they had were one of the last weddings I went to. It was, you know, reading Bible verses, you know, about what love is this, love is that. And even that was a step beyond what it used to be, which is like, I will serve you faithfully and obey what my husband says. Their vows, which they wrote, were much more, I'm my own person, you're your own person. I'm happy that we're together as two people, but we're good. You know, we're going to keep growing separately. I do think that it probably needs to evolve and recognize that it's going to be hard if it's going to create happy circumstances for the people that engage in.
Yeah, it's like when we fight
in it,
I promise to cool off.
Yeah.
And then come back.
Yeah.
Like, that's a solid vow.
And that would not have been able to be said 40 years ago, you know, like, or even perhaps.
Yeah.
More recently.
I'm going to take a walk instead of stabbing you, and then I'll return.
That's a good vow.
And we'll talk it out.
It's a good vow. Like, when I get angry, I promise to take walks. Like, that's a pretty good thing to say.
We'll work it out.
Yeah.
After I've blown off some steam.
Also at the wedding, I don't know. This isn't that common of a circumstance because I'm different, but I've traveled a lot. I haven't been back. I have a fairly large family. And so I technically know everybody, but I don't know them that well, and they don't know me that well. Mm. And it made for like, it reminded me of some of the charisma questions, which is like, how do you deal with the interactions with family? And then this was multiplied by like, how do you deal with interactions with family that you haven't seen in a club environment? And it was, I had kind of wanted to go in and connect with people as if it were a one-on-one conversation like this, and like learn about them and learn about their values and what they're up to. And I, most of the time, did have to accept that it was more like our New York City club experience, which is just saying nonsense back and forth to people, accepting that you're not going to learn anything about them, and just hoping that the nonsense that you say puts smiles on their face. I was just reminded of those two modes of interaction, and I haven't been out in a club in a very long time. So it took me time to adjust to that. I like kept hoping that we would get past the initial stuff. And then I had to be like, oh man, I should have just been doing improv comedy, making nonsense up the whole time, telling people when they ask what I'm doing in California, I should tell them that I'm like a butt model and just, you know what I mean? I should just say things that make them laugh instead of like trying. I was getting like the first three questions into every conversation over and over again. And by the end of the night, I was like, I'm an idiot. I know better than this. I used to go out to clubs.
Try to connect. The way you got to do it in the club is you make the person laugh and then you escape the loud music.
Yes.
You don't do it on the dance floor. You like make the person attracted to you, and they go, hey, do you want to slip off to the back bar where it's not so loud and we can actually talk?
Yeah. And the one conversation I had was standing in line for the bathroom, and then we just stood there for a while and talked for 30 minutes about, you know.
No, it was always about, at least for me, it was always about, at some point getting off the dance floor to a place where you could actually hear each other. I never had like a great connection shouting. So,
Yep. I have a bunch of random shit. Do you want to go?
Sure. I got one that's very near and dear to my heart.
Okay.
I want to talk about the massive rise in shark attacks.
Okay. Is there an actually massive rise?
So like my friend sent me a bunch of news articles. Study found that in the US, there were more shark attacks in 2020 than in any other country. The US had the most. A hammerhead shark thrashed in ankle deep water near beachgoers. Sharks circled women on a floaty in Florida beach. A California drone video showed a growing number of great white sharks swimming near people. Why Smyrna Beach has so many shark attacks? Florida authorities responded to 2 shark attacks on the same day. Shark attack prompts dramatic rescue at Florida. These are just a couple of news headlines from Fox and other news places. So it turns out there have been less shark attacks in 2020 than in 2019. And on average,
nobody's been out there.
There are 0 to 3 deaths a year. 3 is the most ever.
Yeah.
0 is a common occurrence, despite the fact that there are dozens of articles written about from major news sources.
So you'd say there's more articles about shark attacks this year than there are shark attacks this year.
There's certainly more than fatal shark attacks by a large margin.
Got it. Oh, but total. I think most shark attacks probably aren't fatal.
Total shark attacks? Because
they like take a bite out of you and then they go away.
30 in the U.S. in 2020.
Yeah.
It's just panic porn, dude. The news is hilarious and it will lead people to text their friends that surf. Did you see this?
Did you get texts about it?
No, my friend who's a surfer says, dude, I get sent all of these. I get sent all of these every time some stupid news source says it's a slow day. How do we get people to panic today? There hasn't been any actual news to panic about.
Yeah.
Let's ding up shark attacks. It's like bears. This is happening with everything. This is happening with everything that you're panicked about from the news. It's I like shark attacks because it's just such an obviously comical one because it's such a non-existent problem when 0 to 3 people die a year out of 300 plus million people, but gets coverage, people share it with each other, and it's just the news has become panic porn. It's very interesting.
I wonder if Jaws had anything to do with it, or if it was just always like people were just going to be afraid of sharks.
I think Jaws had something to do with it. I think
Jaws literally started like the cultural, the obsession with like shark attacks.
That's fascinating.
Dude.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
No one shares gator attacks. I would not be shocked if gators and crocodiles killed more people than sharks a year.
That's the funny thing in Africa. Like the hippo is more dangerous than lions and cheetahs and all of them combined. I was going to say tigers, but they're not down there, dude.
Oh, it's just fascinating. I think it's fascinating. It was just another reminder of, oh yeah, you're going to read an entire news article. Its purpose is to make you scared of sharks. And you would struggle to think of a smaller issue. Refrigerators might kill more people than sharks.
That was another one. The vending machines were like more dangerous than grizzlies and sharks and all these things.
3 a year, dude. Yeah. 3 a year.
Vending machines.
And they're writing about it in the news.
Yeah.
It just highlighted how amazingly the news is about creating strong emotions of fear and anger in you.
Well, and what's necessary is to rip things away from context. And this is kind of what I was mentioning with
dude, the article said, panic headline. Yeah. More shark attacks in the U.S. than any other country.
Yeah.
30 of them.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Over the course of a year?
Yeah.
In the entire United States?
And it's like the context they do give you is the context that it would be most upsetting.
Yes.
You know,
because they purposefully tried to couch that like it's down from 2019. It's down from 40 to 30.
It seems like a good habit, which is kind of one that you learn in consulting, though is more perhaps just a critical thinking habit, is to just ask for context, you know what I mean? Like to break a thing down, like, oh, it's more than other countries. Well, is it more than previous years? Is it, how many is it relative? You know, like where does this fit? How dangerous is it? Is it high per person in the water? If there were only 30 people in the water and they all got attacked by sharks,
sure.
I'd be like, the ocean is a murderous danger that nobody can go near. So there's a lot of ways to slice that data that would lead to interesting conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I felt that about COVID a lot at the beginning when we were talking about death rates. Okay, death rates where? And, you know, don't need to talk about that too much. Here's a tweet from Bernie that I think is interesting because a lot of people do this.
Bernie Mac?
Bernie Sanders. Mm. A lot of people do this when arguing, and I think it just keeps polarization worse. So what they do, what he does in this, I argue, in this tweet is strawman the other side by not giving the best argument, even though his point is completely reasonable. But it's just like, this isn't the way to do it. So he says, 400 richest Americans' wealth in 1991, $288 billion. 400 richest Americans' wealth in 2021, which is, I guess, 30 years later, $3.2 trillion. So it went up a lot. Okay. Tipped minimum wage in 1991, $2.13 an hour. Tipped minimum wage in 2021, $2.13 an hour. So one thing that he does is he switches from wealth to wage. And if you looked at the richest Americans' wages in 1991 and 2021, they might have gone down because they don't earn in wages. Mm. So like what you would want to compare is the wealth of people. Like even just not comparing evenly. Now, I think that there's a cut that's going to give him the point that he's trying to make, which is that the richest people are getting rich really, really fast and sure, the poorest people are not. But like, why would you go from, why would you say wages in one and net worth in another? That seems so disingenuous. You know what I mean? Because if you did wages for both of them, you wouldn't have a tweet. It would be completely uninteresting.
Honestly, you probably just do net worth for both of them because my guess is net worth is down since debt is up. So
it might be.
You could probably just do net worth to net worth and show that minimum wage workers at least weren't dying of debt back then. And yes, so it's like, oh, it used to be $1,000 on average and now it's negative $20,000. You could actually make a better point maybe by making it apples to apples.
Yeah. And I mean, again, so it's a tweet, you know, it's a product of the,
well, I also don't think Bernie does his own tweets.
Sure.
That's the other thing. Someone was like, Bernie, how could you tweet this?
It's like Bernie didn't do
Bernie this. Didn't tweet this, dude. An intern tweeted this.
Yeah.
Bernie has no idea what his Twitter says.
I guess this is just so much of the debate, you know, when we talk about the wage gap, you just get like one number that is completely misunderstood and out of context. I guess the problem is that it's not just that the platforms are built for whatever 180 or 240 characters. It's that the human brain is built for 240 characters. So the platforms that cater to that are going to be the ones to take off, and the memes that people share and find interesting are going to be instantly comprehensible. And the world is actually incredibly complex and can't easily be tweeted.
Sure. Well, we were talking about this the other day. I won't name them, but we were talking about political YouTubers, and the people that get the most famous are not the people with the most nuanced point that go on and have the arguments in good faith with the smartest person they can find from the other side. Mm-hmm. It's people who, if you already agree with what they believe, they say it in a way that makes you feel smart and like you're on the right side. Yeah. So they find unintelligent people on the other side and then crush them so that you feel validated in your belief. And they largely just say what you think all the time without ever trying to, in good faith, give the best argument for the other side, and sometimes changing their mind. Being a conservative or a liberal YouTube face who swings to the other side's position in an argument because it's convincing. Like, those are not the people, they're out there. They're not the people with millions of subscribers. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's just not how you get a tweet to go viral or how you build an audience by having embraced the full complexity of an issue, trying to appear to understand both sides, and then making your opinion based on what makes the most sense for each issue without going down the same party for all of your opinions. Mm-hmm. So it's like, no, you're going to get crushed by the sensationalist guy who's destroying the other side. Like, just what people want is they just want to confirm that they're right and they're smart and their side is right and the other side is stupid.
Yeah, I think part of what creates that, I think one of the Weinsteins talks about like audience capture, where like you lean a little bit to one side and then your audience becomes predominantly that, and you get applause for half-baked, not fully buttoned up arguments that confirm a belief. But when you go to the other side, if you're not like completely,
dialed in and you have all the stats and it's 100% compelling to a neutral audience, but your audience doesn't believe it, like, no, you suck.
You lose money. So yeah, it's that the very structure of things seems to lead to half-baked ideas of people representing ideas that the other side doesn't have, and then knocking them down as if they were as if they were right.
Yeah, that's the nature of what gets attention.
Yeah. Well, I want to be famous, so.
Hey, At least we have a beautiful, nuanced audience that only sometimes turns on us.
And I'm sure that we've gotten things wrong too, and have fallen victim to all of this stuff. I have a handful of other things, sir.
This isn't something that we've gotten wrong, but it is something I want to address about things that we have been proponents of. Because we've gone on here and talked about how psychedelics are helpful for the right people in the right circumstances, how video games can be good in moderation, how exercise is good for you. And I was just doing, I might do a video for Charisma on Command about video game addiction. And it highlighted to me that almost everything that's good for you, if done incorrectly or too much, becomes bad for you. Like, we know someone who was addicted to working out and became very unhealthy, actually, weirdly enough, because of their diet and exercise habits. Mm-hmm. And video game addiction, while I'm researching this, sometimes you just come across these people who I don't know any personally who had to drop out of college because they were so addicted to playing video games, or got fired because they were so addicted to playing video games. And so we'll come on here and be like, oh, League of Legends is so fun. And it is, unless it ruins your life. And psychedelics, you know, if you take the right safe medicine in a safe space and you have integration set up for afterwards, can be amazingly life-changing, but also can really wreck you if you get a bad substance or a bad environment or whatever it is, you know, have no integration afterwards. And so I don't really have a takeaway, but it just made me realize, like, oh yeah, this stuff, everything has like a very bad dark side if you do it wrong or too much.
Yeah, water will kill you.
Yeah.
Like everything. It's oxygen. Well, probably. I'm sure you can be over-oxygenated and just explode or something.
Well, it's just interesting for me to think. I was like, okay, so like, do I play League of Legends? If I do, am I going to have hard rules for how much I can play? Do I try to purposely take breaks? Like, how do you approach these things so that you're not the person addicted to exercise destroying their body, or the person who's now not playing because it's fun, but they have that compulsion in the back of their mind, like, oh, you should probably play now. Mm-hmm. And I don't have all the answers. It's the video that probably will take weeks and weeks to make as I make other videos in between, because I want to really like understand it. And unlike Charisma, this isn't something I've like studied.
Yeah.
But it was just interesting to think about and watch this stuff as it's something also that I had been doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, I mean, you told me that you were going to play, you're going to limit yourself to one League of Legends, and I don't understand that. I know that you're like in the world of addiction and have been looking at people who have destroyed their lives.
No, I felt it myself that like they say the stages of video game addiction is it starts out fun and then it becomes like you have highs. You have dopamine highs when you win and this and that. And then it's like the fun kind of goes away. You don't get as much joy from the game, but it's still a good way to distract yourself from negative emotions or do something with your friends, even though the highs are gone. And then even that goes away and you just reach compulsion where there's no joy, it's frustrating you, you're getting stressed, your cortisol spiking, but you keep returning to it the next day.
Yeah.
I was like, well, I'm definitely already in stage two with this game. Mm-hmm. Like it's gone past the euphoria. So we actually took a week off of playing, which I think was very good. But that's why I thought, I was like, yeah, I'm not.
Well, I guess one of the things with literature on addiction is that they talk about video game addiction or food addiction in the stages. Like, addiction is just a process that can attach, and it is particularly easy for many people to attach to video games because there's a tight dopamine cycle. But if
that's part of the video, is going to be why is it so much easier to get addicted to video games than basketball, let's say, which is very hard to get addicted to.
Well, I mean, if you look at what are things in one's life, your life, my life, that you do that don't make you really happy, you'll just like, every one of your behaviors is compulsive in nature and none of them really make you that happy. So like, go play some video games. Who cares? Is kind of how I feel. And that's an exaggeration. Obviously there's things that you do for the sheer joy of it, but like so much of what we do is compulsive.
Yeah. I felt like League in particular was in a very short period of time becoming a thing that just wasn't fun, but I was still doing.
Yeah.
And it was just clear to see. I was like, oh, this isn't like, I played for an hour, and at the end of the hour, I'm not happier than I was. It was just frustrating. Mm-hmm. But then I would do it again the next day. So it's just like very clear and new. It was a new behavior, which made it easy to stop and easy to see. And it happened rapidly. Like, it only took a couple months for that to happen. So I was like, oh, this probably isn't the best game to play.
I think what you'll see, and this is, you know, I talk about addiction ladders and emotional mastery, is that, okay, free up the time from League. This is just interesting. Not to say that you shouldn't stop playing League. You will compulsively look elsewhere. You know what I mean? Like, the thing that no one can really do is sit quietly with themselves for an extended period of time without external stimuli, because they'll freak out and they can't handle it because their internal world, all of us, by the most part, perhaps monks being the exception, don't like to be alone with ourselves, even in a comfortable 72 degree room.
Sure. But like yesterday, what I did was went down, hung out with you, mm-hmm. Henry and Ivan.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a better use of time than playing League.
Interesting. Well, I don't disagree with you, but break that down. Why?
At no point was I frustrated or angry.
Got it.
It was just enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And so, yeah, I guess there's two pieces to video. One of the things with video game addiction that I think is perhaps different from other addictions is that that frustration piece. It's like if you have a food addiction, at no point when you're eating the food are you like frustrated.
Well, I think something. You might actually, when you have a real food addiction, I think what you might have is self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
I years ago met somebody who was eating more than they wanted and they couldn't stop, and they would have the compulsion to reach for the candy bar, and then as they were eating the candy bar, instead of thinking about how good it tasted, they were thinking about what a piece of shit they were, basically. Yeah. So I think even with food addiction, you do reach that point where you're like, this isn't fun. I'm not experiencing what a 5-year-old experiences the first time they have a Reese's cup. I'm just doing this because I ran out of the willpower to stop. And now I hate myself for it. I think that's pretty common, at least with some food addicts.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah. I don't know. For me, I mean, I can relate to what you're saying with League, but it has not sunk its claws in so deep that I like just makes me not want to play when I get angry at it. So I feel somewhat still reactive to the emotions that it creates, which is really what I want. It's not to remove frustration and anger. It's to react to frustration and anger with repulsion.
Yeah.
And I think what addiction is when something creates such negative emotions in your life and you react to that with attraction. Like, oh, this is going horrible. Give me more.
Well, I think that often happens with, especially League of Legends in particular. It's like, this sucked. I want to play again.
Yeah.
It's a very common, like, that sucked. My teammate was flaming me, or the other people was flaming me.
I mean, that I understand.
Well, that's the thing. So that's what makes it, then you might have 2 or 3 games in a row where you're not actually ever enjoying yourself, but you're just doing it to get
the... because we're not good enough to win every game.
And so that's the other aspect is there's an experience...
every game,
there's a...
you don't have to be frustrated.
Right. And then, so then there's that sense of progress or growth, or that victory's right around the corner, which is another part of why League is so well designed to keep you playing, because you often feel like the loss wasn't your fault. Mm-hmm. So like, oh, let's just run it again with better luck, I'll win. And now you've played a bunch of games, none of them were particularly fun, your cortisol's up, and it's just like, yeah, it's just not necessarily the best use of time. Even if you're forgetting growth and your just goal is to enjoy yourself, might be better off going to dinner with friends or something.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave this as an open question, because I do think I simultaneously agree with everything you're saying and have been addicted to video games at various points in my life, particularly when I was younger. Like, I was playing to a degree, and I would have that, like, what am I doing here at 3:30 a.m.? Like, like playing Sim Hotel. And then my dreams would be that stupid elevator going up and down. And it was bad. And then I'd wake up in the morning and I would swear it off and I'd do it again. The only way that I ever quit Star Wars was at 3 a.m. snapping the CD and being like, oh, that was a good thing. And then I woke up in the morning and was, what have you done?
Yeah. But you just couldn't, it wasn't like today where you can just re-download it from Steam.
Yes.
I mean, that's even more dangerous part.
That was it, dude. That was it.
Today you just, I'm going to delete League. And then it's free and you just download it. The next day you can solve that problem in 10 minutes. Whereas as a kid, you break the CD, your parents aren't buying you another CD.
Yes. So anyway, so I recognize that, but I think there's another piece that we've talked about, which is video games are at their best games, and games are one of the best parts of being alive.
Sure.
Like, playing games is an important thing. And I do agree that there's a variation in the way that a game is set up that can make it more tilting versus more fulfilling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd be curious, like, what the elements are of a game that is... brings more of the positive with less of the negative.
Mm-hmm.
I could riff right now, but collaboration versus like games where it's me and my friends versus computers seem to breed less like hate. Like when I lose to a human personally, that's when I get most upset.
Well, I think one, playing with your friends versus with strangers, right? Because if you have a stranger on your team that they're doing poorly, that's can be frustrating. Two, having an opponent that talks shit to you,
which
like even if they're beating you, and this is true. These are parallels to sports. Because as I'm making the video, I'm thinking, well, how does this differ from basketball? Yeah. when you play with five people on your team and you know a friend isn't good, but you brought him to the court to play and they mostly pass the ball, it's fine. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you knew that's what they were going to do, hustle and play defense and not take shots. Mm-hmm. They're going to be Ben Simmons.
Yeah.
League is weird because you're with a stranger and it's, if they aren't good, they can benefit the other team. Like a basketball player scoring on their own hoop, which would never happen. Like, the game is designed so that the bad people make the good people even stronger. Mm. And in basketball, it's not the case. So you don't really hate your friend that you brought, that you knew was going to be bad, that's trying his hardest, that's not shooting. Because it's like, listen, maybe your defender's going to float off you to double team someone, but you're not actively scoring on the other team or like tying my shoelaces together when I'm not looking. Whereas in league, it feels like a bad teammate can do that. So it breeds inter-team conflict more because of that. And I think it breeds team versus team conflict more because it's anonymous and location anonymous, basically. Mm-hmm. Versus in basketball, it's like, listen, you can talk shit, but you're not going to talk that much shit because at some point, five people on the other team might just punch you in the face. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is, no one knows your name, no one knows your face, no one knows where you are. And I think that's why you see, especially in like Call of Duty, a drastic jump in the number of N-bombs.
Yeah.
You don't do that when you go play basketball in Venice. That's not how you talk shit. Even when you talk shit, you don't talk it like that.
Yeah.
Because you'll get really hurt. And so I think that aspect breeds more toxicity. So I think you have a game that is similar to basketball in a lot of ways, and that is 5-on-5, but has inherent aspects that make it much more toxic and much more frustrating than a traditional game would be.
Yeah. Well, as I'm thinking, I think there is something very fantastic about human-to-human competition. But when I think of, like, as a kid, the games that we invented and played and didn't have rules, that, like, it was often us versus the environment or mm-hmm. something. And I even think of D&D, which is like this, which is, it's you versus the world of the game master. But even he's antagonistic, but he's not trying to kill you.
But we, like, also played paintball and loved it, which is friend on friend.
Yeah.
And we played basketball and loved it.
I think, yeah, what was it about?
I mean, paintball's literally shooting each other and it hurts and we loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll have to think more on it. I don't want to take the time here to just.
Oh yeah. I have a little bit of an advantage because I've thought about this for the video, but I think, for instance, it's not necessarily that it's human versus human competition. I think human versus human game competition has been around for a while and often ends with a hug. Mm-hmm. Even fighters will talk shit all throughout the lead up to the fight, try to beat each other up for five rounds. And then hug, and the beef is squashed.
Well, I think what you're saying is there is it's like when the winner has social pressure, or because it was a fight, there's something that makes you be gracious in victory, mm-hmm. which makes it easier to lose. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about a fight which is like, dude, we just got real with each other, and like, good fight.
Yeah.
And so it's even that gracious winning is something that doesn't exist in league.
No one ever talked shit. In paintball, the way people do in League of Legends.
Yeah, and that's not true. People say GG, you know, it's not totally the case, but it's...
Yeah, on the good end, you get GG because they're too lazy to abbreviate good game.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the bad end, you get racist slurs, homophobic slurs, general, like, as pointed trash talking as they can about your mother and your performance. Yeah. It's like, that's the spectrum. On the best end, GG.
Yeah. Yes, that's interesting. Yeah, gracious winners, as I think, is... makes losing.
Even when you play paintball against strangers, you would never walk up to them afterwards and just say, you guys fucking suck, you're all stupid.
Yeah, you dude, when you came up behind me, I thought I was dead. Yeah, then I turned around and shot you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If anything, it's
oh my god, you scared me so bad, dude. Yeah.
And in basketball, particularly when the shit talking does go too far, people fist fight on the court. Mm-hmm. There is a natural gate. There's a lid for how much you can talk trash before someone will just punch you in the face. Mm. Doesn't exist in league. So it leads to a lot of pent-up frustration and toxicity towards each other. And I think there's some unique aspects to it relative to in-person games and relative to one-player video games against a computer you're designed to ultimately beat. Mm-hmm. And also, even if you can't, you just probably stop. If you're playing Dark Souls and you can't beat it, you just go on next game.
Yeah.
Like, there's something unique to, I think, shooters and League of Legends that makes them uniquely frustrating but addicting.
Yeah, cool. Well, we'll save some for the video.
Yeah, let us know if you thought that was interesting. If that bored you, maybe I won't even make the video.
So sales tactic that I came across twice since we last spoke was the fake... it's the ability to create reciprocity while the person trying to create it makes it seem like no big deal. And so I've said that. Let me explain. It's when that person says, hey, I'm reading this book about hosts in Vegas who try to track down these whales and get them to gamble at their casino. So they call him up. He says, hey, I'm going to be in Seattle next week. You know, thought I might stop by. We could just grab some lunch. No big deal. He's not going to Seattle. Only if this guy says, yes, we can have lunch, does he go. I got an email. I received an email from someone who said, hey, no big deal. Like, I wrote all these emails for your email list. If you want to see them, let me know. It's like, no, you didn't. You would have included them in the email if you'd written them. There is this, I don't like it because it's false, but just something that I've realized that people do that is very effective is they make coincidence and gifts to you seem like no big deal so that you accept them such that reciprocity might be invoked.
Because this is a common networking thing. People will email, hey, I'm going to be in California if you want to get a coffee, but they're not. And the reason is because
if you
make it seem like the trip is just for getting coffee with you, it feels like too big of a sacrifice by the other person. And then the person accepting is uncomfortable with the level of reciprocity that they feel. They're like, this person booked a flight for me. If I go to this coffee, if I say yes, and then they book the flight, I basically owe them $500 of value or time or something. And so it's easier to say, no, don't fly out. Don't fly out for coffee with me. And so it's this weird thing where because you can't guarantee they'll accept, it's actually better to lower the reciprocity. Whereas if you could guarantee someone would accept it, then the more you could get them to feel reciprocity, the better.
Yes. And it's, it works. I mean, that's the thing. You're one of the tricks that I don't know the best way to phrase it, but people try when they're trying to go after someone that they see as superior or high value to seem very nonchalant about it. When really this guy spent weeks tracking down the guy's address to call him to be like, hey, you know, I'm just on my lunch break over here. I was thinking that maybe he's like, no, you're not. This has been your strategy and your plan for an entire month.
And in the book, it's just to try to get them back to Vegas,
to try to get this guy to switch hotels. So this the book is interesting. It's called Whale Hunting in Vegas. It's not like a not a book that probably did very well. It's just written by some guy, and he breaks down the host thing in Vegas. And we mentioned some of the stuff on the podcast in the past, how they love it when the girlfriend is there, but not when the wife is there, because the wife is going to make him stop gambling, and the girlfriend is the guy that he's trying to impress. That's more.
No, it's fascinating. So when the girlfriend comes to the table, they encourage it, and when the wife comes on the trip, they will give her thousands of dollars in gift certificates just to try to have her go shopping while he's playing so he can play unsupervised.
Yes. Usually, and by girlfriend, typically the ones that they want at the table are the women that that guy has not yet slept with.
Because then he'll bet more. He'll bet bigger to try to impress them.
He'll bet bigger. Yes. And if he has, they give her free gambling or free money to go buy purses and stuff just to get her away.
If he has slept with her.
Yes. And it's really disturbing how efficient this machine. It didn't used to be like this. Mm-hmm. Apparently these were hotels that had casinos, and this guy was one of the one that came in and really just looked at the numbers and said, if you get a guy who's playing like $50,000, $100,000, $250,000, you're like a hand sometimes, or I think 1 to 1,000 is what they call. 1,000 to 100,000 is roughly in the like high roller whale. And then above 100,000 is the whale level. So if you're betting that much per hand, we can have full-time staff dedicated to you even when you're not here. Mm. So we can, and the games that they play with these people are so fascinating, where they'll know that they have like 8 penthouses available, and they'll tell them that they don't. And they'll say, look, I'm going to make this happen for you. You know, like,
sure.
We're going to move people out of there. We got it. And they'll like give them one of the 8 penthouses that they have and had the whole time.
Sure.
So they're just running a con on these guys while smiling to their face, pretending to be their friends.
Well, that's most cons.
And understanding that the money that they get paid is the bonus is based on how much their clients lose. Mm-hmm. So like not only, and it's not just enough to get them at the table. You got to get them drunk and loose and tilted. But also not too much, because you don't want to slaughter the cow. You want to milk the cow. Mm. And so there's this dance that is done.
And the whale hunter gets paid a percentage of what the whale loses.
The bonus that they receive at the end of the year for a lot of these guys is based on what their clients have lose.
Wow. So you're just directly opposed to the best outcome for your clients.
Yes. Yes. but you still want your client to come back. So there is a degree of like, he needs to feel good about his losses. Sure. And another thing that people like, they'll go lose $500,000. But if the guy made them feel that they got the penthouse and they kicked someone out and that they got to go to the show and they kicked someone out of the front row tickets, even though, you know, they didn't, and they got to go to the restaurant that he wanted, whole thing, it was worth it. Even though a trip that would have just cost that would have been like $20K or something.
Sure, sure, sure.
So
I assume they also often provide them with drugs and hookers.
They give them everything. I haven't read about that, but there was an intimated sense that they offer all of these sorts of things. Vegas is a big trap. Vegas is a big trap, and I live there, so I got to see it from a poor person's perspective. But it's interesting to read about what they do for the rich people.
Sure.
And that's all. Just the amount of effort that goes into this and the amount of obfuscating how hard they're working to get these people to come is just interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Should we switch to questions? Because we have YouTube questions, and then apparently we have a lot of Patreon questions. So we're going to spend a lot of time doing that. Mm-hmm. So should we switch over?
Let's do it.
Sick.
Sick.
First one is, are you guys agnostic or atheistic? I've always had trouble understanding atheism in the face of agnosticism. I believe in God or gods. That is a sum total of space, time, matter, energy, and anything else that fundamentally determines universal operations. It rules all of us, blesses us, curses us, and determines our fates and what we think and feel and what we are and will be. If we are in a simulation, the gods are maybe just the creators or the rulers the creators dictated. If not, the gods would be the circumstances that allow us to be. We are free to worship or to express our wills openly to any gods that we choose, relationships, wealth, science, religion, etc. And the ultimate God is the one that allows all of those to fundamentally exist. I see atheism as requiring the same amount of faith as believing in a God, because it takes just as much ego to say I know there is no God as it does to take or as it does to say I know there is a God. I may be wrong about the preposition, but if the amount of faith required for atheism is the same as the faith for belief, then what's the point? One answer could be it frees us to do and be what we want, but that would mean that if we don't even know where consciousness comes from, one answer could be it frees us to do and be what we want, but what would that mean if we don't even know where consciousness comes from, i.e. Sam Harris on free will? I think a truly scientific argument is, as long as consciousness is the tool we use to determine the existence of a God, we cannot know if God exists.
So I think there's some disagreement around the definition of agnostic versus atheist versus anti-theist. So I think the answer to this question really just comes down to what you're defining each of those words as.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's two things. So yes, atheist is just not a theist.
Right.
So a theist says Muhammad or Thor or this. And
my impression is atheist is specific to doctrines.
Yes.
An atheist doesn't make a claim about.
So, and what you just offered was not necessarily doctrine, but it was a specific claim of there is an ultimate God and there are these gods and it allows for this. And an atheist would say, I see no proof for that, so not that.
And an agnostic would say, I don't know if Jesus rose from the dead. I don't know if Moses parted the Red Sea.
Yeah.
Because my grandpa and I always talk about this, and we just have different definitions. He thinks an agnostic is what you said, and he thinks an atheist is.
Then you agree.
And that's ultimately. we bicker, and then I go, listen, we're just defining these words differently. Yeah. Like, whatever, we're on the same page. But my impression is that an agnostic just says, I don't know. Maybe Thor is the god of thunder. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And that an atheist says,
takes specific claims and says there's not enough evidence, so no.
Give me your book. I don't believe that one. Yeah. Give me your book. I don't believe that one. And then an anti-theist says there's no possible way that there's anything that can be defined as God outside of our current scientific understanding or something. And I've actually never met an anti-theist. Mm-hmm. But that's my impression of those words. And so depending on how you define the words is probably where you end up falling.
Yeah. Regarding that it takes just as much faith to believe, I don't know that that's entirely true, because if you substitute God for something else that we don't know, so, you know, that I'll make a particular claim, because even your version of God, while broad, is particular. There are things that it is not. So, like, if I say, look, it's possible that there are invisible elves behind my head that no one can see, and it takes just as much faith to say that there are not invisible elves behind my head that don't speak as it does to say that there are. So we're both in the same boat. This is one of the burden of proof is on the person saying something, right? Where the atheist stands is like, show it to me. Like, give me some evidence that there were elves. Like, yes, there's also no evidence of the absence of elves, but I'm, you know, maybe they're dwarves, maybe they're kobolds, who knows? So that this can again come down to semantics, but it does not necessarily take as much faith to have an atheistic belief about anything or an a belief about anything, including God, as long as you're making a specific claim, which it sounds like you are, like your God is particular.
Yeah, you're saying, I claim there's invisible elves behind me. You say, okay, well, by being an atheist, I claim there could be nothing. There could also be invisible dwarves. There could also be, like, I'm taking every other possibility, and you're taking there's elves. And so then my question to you is, why do you think there are elves instead of this entire realm of other possibility? Yeah. And so the burden of proof falls to the person making the specific claim.
Yes. But there might be, you know.
And your definition of agnostic might be the definition of atheist we use. This is what I often come to in these conversations.
And then I guess there was a question about the, like, so there's two questions. There's, is it true or isn't it true? And then there's a question of, like, is it practical, helpful, useful, right? There was something about, like, what does it do for us to believe in a God or not believe in a God?
Right. Or if we don't know where consciousness comes from, then what would that mean?
So, sorry, can you read it again just so I, because there was a lot in there.
Yeah. So I may be wrong about the preposition, but if the amount of faith required for atheism is the same as the faith for belief, then what's the point? One answer could be it frees us to do and be what we want. But what would that mean if we don't know where consciousness comes from?
Yeah. So I think we sort of answered that is that I disagree that
it doesn't take as much faith.
Yeah, that it doesn't. And in terms of, like, there's always this question is, oh, what will happen if we don't believe, or what does it allow us to do? And I think that needs to be treated very separately from, is it true? So, like, it might be better, the kids might behave better if they believe in Santa Claus. And it might be true that kids who don't believe in Santa Claus go up and commit a bunch of murders and pester other children and all sorts of things. But that is separate from the claim that Santa Claus comes down your chimney and gives you presents. So what it does isn't still an interesting question to believe, but it has nothing to do with the truth or falseness of the claim. So yeah, what does atheism do? I don't know, really. It opens the possibility for me to find the truth is what it does. Because I'm not saying I'm anti any specific claim, but I remain open to evidence. So when I do psychedelics and I see stuff, I go, oh damn, like maybe this points me in a direction of a deeper understanding of the universe.
Yeah, but it's not about the pros and cons. Like if it came to be that a world that believed aggressively in a particular religion was just a better world
by every conceivable measure.
Yeah. That doesn't have any impact on if that religion is accurate or not in their description of the creation of the universe.
Yes. Yeah. Cool.
Next is, so I'm kind of having a mindset problem, which is essentially that I don't want to start new things, which would always make me look bad or stupid. I've always done everything above average or at least better than the people around me, so taking on a new task is difficult, and not being good at something is something that I notice myself avoid. Any tips on overcoming that and having more of an open mind and being okay with the fact that I will not always be the best at something new?
I was kind of like this in high school. Like, my identity was that of the kid who got shit easy without working. So if it would require work, it just would be like, well, then I won't do it.
As someone that's always been naturally bad at everything and excelled with a lot of work, I can't identify to this question at all. So yeah. I'll let you take it.
I think a thing that did somehow shift in me was that I identified not as the person who was had it or was quick, but the person who was there's a certain degree of intelligence required to emotional intelligence or whatever, to admit that you're not good at things. And like, that was kind of like, I sunk my teeth a bit more into that identity. And so for you, you'll have to figure out what like makes you feel good, but this is an identity level issue. And so I'll give you a couple of options, because none of these are true of you, but some of these might appeal to you and you'll just go, yes, this is my new principle that I'll live by. So one is, the most intelligent thing that I can do is suck at stuff. You know what I mean? Cause that's, and that's the person that I'm going to be. The person that I'm going to be is the one that doesn't get it at first, but gets it right eventually or whatever. And I'm trying to think of when it was around college-ish that sort of shifted and I became, and I shifted from the kid who got everything very easily to then I was going to go learn charisma, which was like the hardest thing for me on the planet.
Well, the shift, the thing for me, which it's not really a shift, but it's just the mentality I had, is like, I don't really care how good I am on day one. I just care how good I get. And I'm very confident by working out this, I'm going to get better than almost all of you. And so like, that was my motivators with basketball or charisma or school. It was like, okay, I'm not good day one. This doesn't affect my self-esteem at all. I'm going to crush. And like, got me to being pretty good at MMA and decent at basketball. And so that was the mindset that I had. It wasn't really a shift, but it's one I might recommend. It's just like, yeah, take pride in how good you are in the absolute. Don't compare it like, oh, your day one is better or worse than this person's day one. It's like, who cares? Just work at it and then be good at it and then take the joy of whatever skill you're trying to learn.
So personal power too is really good for shifting identity level beliefs. It's the Tony Robbins course. We've talked about it in the past. One of the exercises that is likely, he has several, but to do a pain pleasure analysis of your current belief and of a separate belief. So pick the belief that like sounds like it could be the juiciest to you to have. Your current belief is that you're really good at stuff day one. And so you write down first, like, what's all the pleasure you get out of that? And you're like, makes me feel smart. I feel better than my friends. I never have to admit that I'm not good at things. Like, you want to take an accounting of what you get out of it. Then you want to take an accounting of everything that it costs you. It's like, I'm only going to get to do the things that I'm already good at.
Anything I'm not
like,
good at day one, I never get to be good at.
And you really want to like beef this one up. Like, oh, I'm also not good at that thing that's really valuable to me. So I'll never be good at whatever. And like, make it sting.
Yeah. I will never get the person that I desire dating wise because I'm refuse to improve at this.
Or like doing a self
intervention. I'm going to lose every time I do this sport or activity that I care about because I refuse to let myself try it or whatever it is. There's going, especially if you want to change this, I promise that this is holding you back in some way.
And to take like a really thorough accounting of how it's holding you back. And then it's just how would that shift if I adopted this new belief? Like, what would my life look like? Like, well, in 6 months, I'd probably be way better at just take dating as an example. And I'd probably be with someone that I liked. And he runs you through exercises like that. That's one of them that are useful for really changing the beliefs that instruct a lot of behavior. So I would start there.
Next is, I'm a recent college graduate that just moved home from Vancouver where I lived for the last 5 years. While I was in Canada, I joined a fraternity and saw tremendous growth in myself both socially and I'm in my now independent charisma and in my own independent charisma. Now I'm back home in Dallas where I'm living with my parents while attending pilot school and I can't help but feel that I'm in a state of personal regression for as long as I'm under my parents' roof. I plan on staying here until I finish training and finding work. I try to branch out as much as I can through the gym, jiu-jitsu, and reconnecting with old friends from high school, but it still doesn't match the level of social interaction that I had when I was in university. My main question is, what steps can I take to be more comfortable with being myself and not feeling like I'm slipping back into being the person that I was before I left for school many years ago?
University is so special for this. It really is just like, you live in a dorm with a bunch of people your age, and you walk on a quad with a bunch of people your age, and then you go to a class with separate people that you've not met who are also your age, and then there's a game. So there's nothing like it. There really isn't. And you're never going to have an environment that is so conducive to socializing and also like transformation, because when you get there, nobody knows who you are.
It's also pretty common to regress, though, if you go back. Like, if you did pilot school in a new city that wasn't Dallas and wasn't Vancouver, you probably wouldn't feel yourself regress as much. I think there's a sense that your environment can just trigger, oh yeah, I remember this place. This is how I behave in this place.
Yeah. Yes. So one, don't sweat it too much. There's things that you can do, but like recognize that what you're experiencing is very, very, very normal.
How did you do it? Because in college at American University, you started out shy. Then you went to Costa Rica. Then you came back and you didn't revert back. How did you maintain the charismatic improvement you had made in Costa Rica?
Didn't have strong ties at American, honestly. That was why. I had like a handful of friends.
So
like,
you didn't have any anchors?
I had very few anchors, and they were anchors still. You know what I mean? Like the handful of people that I did know were like, didn't really like or get it. But
you just went out and made new friends that didn't know you before?
Or that knew me very kind of. And when I got back, I was like, oh, we'll have like a get-together. It'll be good to see you. And like, it wasn't it was different, but it wasn't like, oh my gosh, you've changed, this is a problem. It was like, oh, this is so cool because I am not attached to you being the way that used to be.
Versus parents.
Yes. And I had a handful of friends who didn't like all of a sudden going out to like bars, which I never used to do. I used to just hang out with them and play video games. And that was like, you know, they didn't love that.
They found out that.
Yeah, they weren't huge fans of that.
Did it start with this letter?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And also, there were a handful of people from the study abroad where I was different with them, and they just expected me to be.
Oh, so they came back to AU with you, yeah. And they saw you, and they're like, ah, it's the life of the party guy. And you're like, oh, yeah.
Hell yeah. So, yeah, that was how I did it.
Got it. Interesting. So, less applicable.
Yeah, less applicable. So, look, when I'm home and I can't cut out, I guess what I would say is it's kind of just like, look, I eat junk food when I'm home, and I try to just put the muscle back on, or not the muscle, because I try to eat better when I get back. So I don't know how long you're going to be in that environment, but it's really tough, man. It's really, really tough. The things that shift, that I have seen shift with my family, is not that I'm much more charismatic, but that I can be more, we have more open and honest conversations. But I'm not, like, super charismatic, cool, fun party guy when I'm with them. So I don't know that that's even what I have experience aiming at. Here's what I did. When I found myself in environments where my charisma was dying, like in D.C., I had to leave. Like, I went into my boss's office and told him, I hate the way that I'm behaving. It's not your fault. Like, I don't like who I am in this city. I need to go live with my friend in New York. And for that reason, I'm out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess what I would say is the environment really is critical. And if you don't have the opportunity to see people your age or new people, you're going to have to. So either find a way to do that in the space that you're in, where you do have that ability to socialize, or
just double down on getting out of pilot school as quickly as possible. And then,
I
mean,
look,
move.
I was in DC for a year and a half. You know,
mm-hmm.
And I was visiting Ben as often as I could. I was getting on these, like, they wound up being 7-hour bus rides to New York City on Bolt bus. And just to have that opportunity to
go out for a weekend and remember what it was like to be charismatic.
Yeah. Yeah. So good news, bad news, I guess, in my experience there is that there's not like a really easy way to overcome an environment that is really not built for like social growth or socializing.
What was the good news? That's the bad news.
The good news is you're not doing anything wrong.
Mm.
You know, change your environment. And it's okay. It's also okay to, like, in my experience, to spend a year and a half somewhere that's not what you want.
Get your pilot's license and then get out, basically.
Yeah, and I still would go into the office and try to, like, I was the friendliest dude in the office, and I made friends with the president, and at the parties I would be the life of the party, and I would take the opportunities that I had, but it wasn't... That was a big reason why I left, was to move to New York and hang out with Ben and work on this stuff that I was not working on in D.C.
All right.
Last one. What podcast do you guys regularly listen to?
Critical Role.
Yeah. I listen to Dark Horse, which is with Brett Weinstein sometimes. Are there any others? Joe Rogan Clips, now that he's no longer on YouTube, I listen to. I see clips from... Recently, Sagar, who was on Sagar and Crystal. I'm not a huge podcast. I'm more of like a short video guy. Cool. All right.
Patreon.
Let's do it. Do I have to? Oh, if you guys want to come over to Patreon, we have a lot of questions today. So if you want to see much more of Ben and I, that's the place to do it. And you can check us out. So for the rest of you who aren't coming, hope you had a good day.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.